I'm very sorry I missed the beginning of Tony's remarks. I was in the House of Lords, which is an example of very ancient infrastructure, which hasn't really been modernised much in five centuries, but still does the serves the nation very proud. Alas, though, it was built for, it's a bit like the London Underground. It was built for 150 members, the House of Lords, when it was constructed, the modern Parliament in the 1850s. It now has about 800, and therefore it takes about half an hour to conduct a vote. It must be the most inefficient way of conducting a vote in the world, having people lining up to go through funnels, which were built for barely a quarter of the number who are there. So it does take rather a long time. And I see several other members of the House of Lords here who didn't even thought that the trouble was too great even to attempt it. And that is part of the the challenge that we face in the Upper House. But anyway, that's the reason why I'm late. Tony and his team are doing an excellent job of improving the quality of infrastructure delivery and providing a very capable central resource for assisting departments and agencies as they go about the delivery of infrastructure and working with the private sector and other partners in putting the packages and the support and the finance together that enable those projects to proceed. But looking at the challenges that we face in infrastructure, the prior stage of longer-term planning and the making of commitments on the part of the state, because most of these major infrastructure issues, even if they're financed and delivered by the private sector, need the consent of the state and usually the state intimately involved in the planning. That isn't something which, to put it diplomatically, we've been brilliant at in the last few generations. I'm being followed by my good friend Terry Morgan, who's doing an outstanding job at as chairman of Crossrail, and Crossrail I think is going to be like the other projects that Tony just mentioned, the Olympics, HS1, as you put it, the golden thread of projects. I think the Crossrail is going to be very much in that line, and indeed is at the moment promising quite a high probability of a very significant underspend, which I've got designs on, so I think that's very welcome to, and if we can bring this project on time and under budget, that'll be a phenomenal success. However, the story of Crossrail itself is quite a salutary tale of the way we go about transport planning. Crossrail, this is the 42nd anniversary of the first publication of the plan for Crossrail. In 1974, when it was first planned, it was planned and then shortly after, announced. And shortly after, cancelled. It was cancelled in a great bonfire of infrastructure projects in the mid-1970s. When Tony Crossland became Environment Secretary in 1974, he didn't give much support to Crossrail, which was in due course cancelled. He cancelled the Channel Tunnel. He cancelled the Third London Airport, which was in the process of being constructed at Macklin at the time. Indeed, the piles are still there. He said that projections for future aviation had been grossly exaggerated and it was very unlikely that we were going to need a further airport. That had followed quite an exhaustive process of planning with a Royal Commission established in the 1960s. I mean the story of the airport, which I'll come and say a bit more about in a while, because it so goes to the root of how we do these things both well and badly. The Royal Commission under a judge had reported in the late 60s had actually recommended a site in the Chilterns for the new London airport. The Heath government came in and rejected that, but there was a minority report which recommended a site in the estuary, which legislation was then passed for, but it didn't get cross-party support. And as I say, it was cancelled in 1974. Crossrail, the plan lay around in the 70s, but the Victoria Line had just been completed. The Victoria Line, which of course the benefit-cost ratio was very bad for at the time, it very nearly didn't proceed. When it did proceed, it was significantly de-scoped on the grounds that A, there was a big shortage of money at the time, but also secondly because it was thought that the traffic projections were OTT, and therefore, which is part of the reason why the stations are also small on the Victoria Line, which is the big problem which successive modernisations, including what's going on at Victoria itself, are now trying to deal with. The circulation space was dramatically reduced in most of the stations as part of a de-scoping exercise, but Crossrail came in the wake of that and was no action taken. Then both of the first two proposals for Crossrail were cancelled by the Treasury at various different stages of being taken forward. And this is only the third iteration, which has gained consent. So the moral I draw from that and from the big problems we've had in getting a modern energy infrastructure strategy going, and the big problems we've got with the airports, is that longer-term infrastructure planning can, if it's done on an objective basis, can hope to bring two different elements to bear, which will be positive. The first is a more objective fact base than is accepted simply by governments declaring projects, which is what happens otherwise. And secondly, some attempt at building cross-party consensus, because without cross-party consensus, it's not possible to move on any of these projects that span a parliament. The reason why Crossrail is proceeding is that there was a cross-party consensus which enabled it to survive both a change of government and a change of mayor. Otherwise, it would certainly have been cancelled in 2010 because the price tag was so large that it would have been a very big immediate saving for the incoming government. And it was just at that moment when construction was starting, so it was at the ideal time for the Treasury to cancel a project, as it had. It would have been exactly the same stage as Maplin was cancelled in 1974. Now, where we get this right with cross-party consensus, it is possible to move rapidly, and as rapidly as any other nation, democratic nation that has planning constraints does. HS2, for which I was responsible in its planning stage at the Transport Department, was announced almost exactly 6 years ago, 6 years and a few weeks ago. The legislation for HS2 is now in the House of Lords and will be passed by the end of this year. Construction will start next year. Tony and his team are all over it because there's a big ongoing issue about costs and how they're best managed and reduced. And I mean, this is a huge issue. I mean, his slide there, which highlighted it, it's probably one of the biggest single issues we face in infrastructure delivery. Why is it that our projects cost so much more than equivalent projects elsewhere? HS2, as I understand it, not only is the benchmarking studies we've done showing it's very, very significantly higher in route mileage, allowing for tunnels and other factors than any other high-speed line in the world, and around twice the level of equivalent schemes in France, but will probably turn out, adjusting for cost, to be the second most expensive high-speed rail scheme ever developed. The second most expensive being HS1. So we don't have a great track record in this respect, and it's worth discussing in the discussion period why this is so. But the cross-party consensus has held, and as a result, it would have been possible to construct what is the biggest infrastructure project in Europe and an extremely complex project with massive controversy attached within 16 years of it first being announced. Now, for a scheme of its size, this is 100 miles of completely new track going out of central London with the construction of four major stations. And a hugely contested planning process. That is about as fast as it's possible to do this. And then the whole 330 miles of HS2 going up to Manchester and Leeds, if things proceed on the projected basis, and it looks as if they will, because once you've got to Birmingham, the pressure then, including the political pressure, to get to Manchester and Leeds will be unstoppable. This will have happened by 2033, which is only another 7 years after that. So it is possible to get these schemes moving fairly fast, where you have cross-party consensus that holds. Now, HS2 from the outset was geared to achieving cross-party consensus. I went to the Transport Department, but we do these things in a kind of serendipitous and almost haphazard way in this country at the moment. The question is how we can systematise it. Having long been attracted to the arguments for significant transport modernisation, particularly of rail, I went to the Transport Department. Indeed, I asked Gordon Brown if I could go to Transport from Education. He was astounded, so nobody ever asked him to go to Transport before. It wasn't regarded as a frontline department in any way, because it looked to me as if the moment was there where you could take high-speed rail and big rail infrastructure investment forward. This was in 2008-09, because the opposition Conservatives have just come out in favour in principle of high-speed rail. Now, in infrastructure, there's a massive yawning gap at the planning stage, let alone the delivery stage, between agreeing things in principle and actually having a plan. Nobody had a plan for what H2 might look like. But once there was that opening in principle, it looked to me as if somebody came forward with a plan, and it needed to be, I thought, from the Labour side, so because we were in government and could get the thing moving fast, then you had this opportunity, which might not recur for some period of time, to establish a consensus behind a plan which could then proceed. The irony of the situation is the reason why there was a cross-party consensus, though, and these things are also contingent, is because the Conservatives had committed themselves to high-speed rail on the rebound from opposing the expansion of Heathrow. What they did was at the same time to announce their opposition to the expansion of Heathrow and the third runway there. But the other side of the coin was that they would support the building of a high-speed line, which, so the argument went, would lead to a significant reduction in the need for domestic aviation, because this would all move to high-speed rail. Now, unfortunately, the one thing that HS2 does not do is lead to much change in domestic aviation. There's hardly anyone tiny numbers who fly between London and Manchester since the modernisation of the West Coast Main Line was completed. None, I mean, virtually none, apart from a few interlining passengers, need none, because there are no flights from Birmingham to Heathrow, so who do that journey? And in order to get any significant reduction in domestic aviation as a result of high-speed rail, you've got to get to Edinburgh and Glasgow, and that's going to be, to coin a phrase, at the end of the queue, because it's the way these construction is going to happen. It's going to take a very long time. So there are a lot of ironies in the way that these things do and don't happen. But it's because that happens, the judgment that I made at the time was that the Conservatives would need to stick with their commitment to HS2, because otherwise they'd find it very hard to sustain the arguments they'd made for opposing Heathrow at the time. And also, the then Shadow Chancellor and now Chancellor, George Osborne, was, as I knew, very attracted to high-speed rail because he'd been to Japan and seen how it worked there and thought that we could learn some lessons here. So it was very contingent. But if you're looking at it in terms of the planning of the national infrastructure, this ain't any great basis on which to think that you can take these decisions over the medium long term, which is hoping that the contingent factors come together. What we should have done, if you look at high-speed rail, is we should have started building our intercity high-speed rail network, London, Birmingham, Manchester, Leeds, so linking up the major conurbations. We should have done it at the same time as the Italians and the French did it, which was in the 1970s. We should have planned it then and started and delivered it over the following 20 years. And not only would the national payback have been significantly greater if we had done it, transforming the connectivity of the major cities, but we would also have avoided successive upgrades of the West Coast Main Line and all of the many of the associated costs, which have come to tens of billions. And actually, if you look at the investments that took place as a result of not doing high-speed rail and the welfare foregone, I suspect that the difference isn't that great. So having some independent body that has the power to make recommendations which government can then accept or reject, but creating a body of support behind them makes it more likely they'll be accepted, I think could only be a plus. It's not a panacea. It doesn't guarantee that governments will take up these proposals, but it does make it more likely, and it does act as a kind of conscience on the political system. And I hope also, when it comes to the monitoring of the infrastructure pipeline that Tony just talked about, that the independent body over time can take a role in monitoring the pipeline, and in doing so can bring some edge into the system in holding the feet of ministers and the state to the fire in actually delivering projects. My final comment would be another historical one, because all these things, understanding the past, which is so important to understanding the future. Though it is true that that many of our big infrastructure projects have been, in terms of when they've happened, have been serendipitous and have depended on the kind of contingent factors that I described in the case of HS2, and I was keen to describe it to you so you understand how things can sometimes do gel and sometimes don't, which is the reason why High Speed 2 is proceeding at the moment, but the third runway isn't. In fact, actually, we plan a great deal more than we let on, and by definition, it's impossible to do anything of this scale without without planning. And most of our planning is actually pretty sound. The question is whether it's implemented and when it's implemented. So a whole generation of energy capacity was planned by the CEGB and planned pretty well and delivered over a reasonable period, and was a great testament to the modernization and success of energy infrastructure planning in the 1960s and 70s. The airports themselves, if you go and look at airports policy over the last 50 years, that has been much more planned than we realise. Heathrow is where it is, not again because of serendipity, but because it was planned that way. The Abercrombie report of 1944, which looked at post-war planning in London, has a whole section looking at options for London's international airports, weighing proximity to the economic heart of the capital and its economic hinterland, which was then as now to the west, with inconvenience to local residents, and goes through a whole set of, I think it's 10 potential sites, including Croydon, which was then the international airport, but others including what is now Gatwick and Stansted and sites out further west, and lighted on Heathrow as the best site optimising proximity to the economic heart of the capital with inconvenience to local residents. And indeed, actually, though the inconvenience to local residents has been the big problem, which has beset Heathrow ever since, a good part of the reason why it's so successful is because it is located where it is, very close to the economic heart and hinterland that it serves. Abercrombie also recommended that there should be a fast rail link from the airport to the city centre. Well, it only took us 45 years to construct that, that once it was constructed, he thought it would take half an hour because he wanted it to go south and into Victoria. When it was finally constructed into Paddington, it was 15 minutes. Well, there's no major airport size serving a city anything like London size, which is as good a connectivity with its city centre as that. And he also recommended that there should be a motorway box and hub that connected it too. Well, that took slightly less. That only took 35 years to complete, but again, was all part of the Abercrombie plan. And successive modernisations and expansions of Heathrow have been in accepting, essentially, because we've, as I say, there have been attempts at doing other airports, but accepting basically the Abercrombie plan and rationale of the mid-1940s. The War Cabinet in the mid-1940s as well also planned the motorway system, which was, and the one that was finally constructed, was remarkably similar to the plans laid before the War Cabinet in 1943. Now, plans for the motorways had been put forward in the 1930s. So Leslie Hall Belisha, who was then the Transport Minister, rejected them as inherently fascist motorways because they were straight. Although he's remembered for the Belisha Beacon. And we didn't do straight roads, which in England, you never get the English to agree to all the constraints that were necessary to do it. So it was the plans weren't properly developed until the War Cabinet, and then it took until the late 1950s. And in some ways, the most remarkable Transport Minister of the war in terms of actually delivering things, which was Ernest Marples, who essentially then got, in the course of 5 years as Transport Minister, got the whole of what's now the modern motorway system. In construction or to an advanced stage of planning. And again, that wouldn't have happened but for the plans that had been successfully drawn up over the previous 15 years. So we do it. Ultimately, we generate infrastructure which, if you look at all of those areas I've talked about, is pretty much as good as that which is developed elsewhere. Our problem is that we don't do it in a sufficiently timely fashion. And I think partly because of that, but there are other factors too, it is far too expensive. But London is showing how we can start to tackle these issues more systematically. There is a London infrastructure plan. There's a mayor of London who commands significant resources and can therefore himself prioritise projects. We have the Thames Tideway Tunnel, we have the Silvertown Tunnel, we have Crossrail 2, which the government's just given commitments to following recommendations which my commission made, which are including legislation to proceed by the end of this parliament. So if that sticks, that is all a much smoother process than Crossrail 1. And I think that is because we do have what is essentially, in the Mayor of London and the Greater London Authority, a regional infrastructure planning authority with real teeth, real political clout, and real resources. And looking at the success, the golden thread that Tony identified, the model that London provides, and our success at delivering very major projects over the last 15 years, I'm optimistic that we might do it somewhat better over the next generation than we've done over the last generation in terms of taking timely decisions. But the acid test, I think, is whether we can ultimately take a decision on the biggest single infrastructure constraint that we face as a country in terms of loss of national welfare, which is expanding our major hub airports and overcoming the controversies that have beset that. If that one is resolved over the next year or 18 months, then I think people will believe that we are actually capable of grappling with these big issues, and there aren't any that are off limits. If that one isn't resolved, I suspect it's going to be the big elephant in the room in major discussions over infrastructure planning for a generation to come. And we'll be back in arguments about whether we should have a completely new airport. We'll go round the, no doubt, round the circuit of having another version of the Roskill Commission looking at entirely new sites for an airport. That almost certainly won't happen, and therefore we'll be back in the business of expanding Heathrow in about 15 years' time. Thank you very much.